And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome back to The Curious Clinicians, a medical podcast that asks why. I'm Avi Cooper, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Hannah Abrams and Tony Brew. How are you both doing?
Doing great.
I'm doing fantastic.
Feeling salty? Feeling salty?
Not at all.
Not in the least.
I will a little bit.
Well, for this episode, we're going to be comparing two conditions, heart failure with reduced ejection fraction and heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and ask why these states are associated with sodium retention. So, Tony, where should we begin?
I want to state very clearly up front that I won't be offering a really tidy explanation for sodium retention in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, so also known as HFpEF. I was telling these guys before we started recording, I've searched for years and years for an answer to this question and have found only partial explanations, like really, really partial. And so this is actually one of those episodes where I'm really interested in what the audience has to say. Because I think when our discussion is complete, there's probably something that will be missing. So I just need to get that sort of, preface out of the way.
So tell us more about why you've been curious about this for so long.
Well, I think like most of us, I learned that heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF, that in that condition, you've got decreased cardiac output, and that leads to a decrease in effective circulating volume and neurohormonal activation. And this all leads to an increase in norepinephrine, renin, angiotensin II, and aldosterone. And collectively, that conspires to cause sodium retention. I suspect that the two of you guys kind of heard a similar story or were taught a similar sort of mechanism. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
And I don't know that I ever doubted it.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that that's what happens in HFrEF, but I think there is a little bit of a paradox. Because if we assume that the cardiac output is not decreased in HFpEF, the question becomes, what's the inciting event leading to neurohormonal activation and sodium retention? And is there even neurohormonal activation at all?
Well, before we get to the potential explanations that you found for sodium retention in HFpEF or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, does it make sense to sort of, maybe briefly establish that the mechanism that we all learn for HFrEF is actually true? Sort of like Hannah said, we haven't really doubted that. And I guess I'm a little bit worried you might tell us that we're wrong here as well.
I mean, if past is any guide, that might be the case. But I'm actually pretty confident that we have got the pathophysiology of HFrEF worked out. And by we, I mean all the scientists who came before us. So there are early animal models of HFrEF, and those show that if you experimentally lead to a reduction in cardiac output, this causes an increase in renin and aldosterone. And that in these animal studies, this was accompanied by an increase in water intake and an increase in sodium retention. Of course, we also have human data that shows that in HFrEF patients, there is an increase in renin and norepinephrine when you compare these patients with those who don't have heart failure. So I think we're on pretty solid footing in HFrEF when we say that there's a decrease in cardiac output, and this leads to a decreased effective circulating volume and a compensatory increase in renin, aldo, norepi. And as I said earlier, that sort of connection, one to the other, leads to the sodium retention.
So the crux of the question or the paradox really centers around this idea that people with HFpEF or preserved EF have a normal cardiac output. And that makes a lot of sense because their left ventricular ejection fraction is normal. But is there actually data to show that cardiac output is normal in HFpEF?
Yeah. So at rest, most patients with HFpEF have a normal cardiac output and normal cardiac index. Sort of depending on the study, they'll report one or the other. But what's interesting and something that I hadn't learned is that these patients lack cardiac output reserve. So basically, they're unable to increase their heart rate with exercise, leaving them unable to augment their cardiac output to the same extent as patients who don't have HFpEF. There are probably multiple reasons why this happens. So for example, there is probably downregulation of beta receptors and desensitization to catecholamines because catecholamines are chronically elevated in this state. But regardless of the mechanism, this chronotropic incompetence, this inability to augment heart rate, means that with exercise, the cardiac output isn't raised as much in HFpEF patients as it is in patients who don't have HFpEF.
So if neurohormonal pathway activation is sort of the key step to lead to sodium retention and sort of the volume overload state that we see in heart failure, is there evidence to suggest that in HFpEF, that this lack of cardiac output reserve with exercise, it's enough to activate that neurohormonal, you know, pathway and lead to that sodium retention?
It's a great question, and it's one that I tried to find a clear answer to. And so the short answer is I don't know. I'll say that I haven't seen authors suggest that this chronotropic incompetence and this lack of cardiac output reserve, I haven't seen authors suggest that this is enough to lead to neurohormonal activation. And my sense is that if the only time the cardiac output, cardiac index is inadequate is with exercise, that that alone probably isn't enough to lead to the neurohormonal activation. But this is, again, where I'll be interested to hear from listeners to tell me, no, Brew, you've got this wrong. Here's a paper showing that it is.
So what about sort of just, you know, in general, are some of those factors that we've already talked about, renin, aldosterone, norepinephrine, that are increased in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, are they also increased in these patients with preserved ejection fraction as well?
Again, a little bit of a hedgy answer. It depends on the study, but the answer is like a maybe probably. So, you know, in 1993, Benedict et al. Published an analysis of a cohort of patients that had been included in the SOLVED registry. And so the SOLVED study actually had it aimed to examine patients with a depressed ejection fraction, but they had patients in the registry with an ejection fraction greater than or equal to 45%. And so this 1993 study by Benedict looked at that subset of patients with a preserved EF. And the investigators examined the values of norepinephrine and renin in these patients with HFpEF and compared them to patients with HFrEF and to patients without heart failure. And they found that the values of both renin and norepinephrine were lower in HFpEF patients than in HFrEF patients. And this is something you kind of see repeatedly in the studies looking at this. They also found that the norepinephrine values were no different in HFpEF than in controls. There was a slight increase in the renin levels in HFpEF compared to controls, compared to those who didn't have heart failure, but it was only a very, like, you look at the figure, and we'll post this in the show notes, it's like very mildly increased, but it was there. So fast forward about 10 years, and there was a study published in 2002 in JAMA. And this reported, again, mildly increased norepinephrine levels in patients with HFpEF when compared with controls. So you can already see there's a little bit of a kind of a mixed bag here. The most recent data that I looked at kind of supports this idea that patients with HFpEF, when you compare them to HFrEF, they have lower levels of renin, aldosterone, and norepinephrine. So overall, if you kind of look at this data, it's, I would say, conflicting. Some show elevations in norepinephrine compared to controls, while others don't. Some show elevations in renin compared to controls, others don't. I think the one consistent finding is that the values in HFpEF are consistently lower than the values in HFrEF. And so when I look at this and I sort of take it as a whole, and I think this is how others interpret it as well, I think these data suggest that in HFrEF, neurohormonal activation is central, with studies sort of consistently supporting this mechanism. But in HFpEF, neurohormonal activation, it might play a role, but the data is a lot less consistent and I would say less convincing.
So this seems to maybe fit in with the fact that at least traditionally and in a lot of the research and practice to date, blocking neurohormonal activation has been less successful in HFpEF. Does that seem like the correlation?
Yeah, I think as a general statement, that's mostly accurate. And, you know, when I learned about HFrEF and I learned about the most effective treatments, I thought it was so cool that the treatments followed the pathophysiology, right? If you blunted the increase in catecholamines with beta blockers and you blunted the RAS activation with ACE inhibitors, ARBs and ARNIs and aldosterone antagonists, like the patients got better. There was a mortality benefit. I thought that was like just like exactly what you want to see, pathophysiology leading to treatment. But, you know, these studies just haven't been as effective in RCTs of patients of with HFpEF. So these therapies have not been as effective. And I don't know that this is all that surprising in light of the kind of mixed bag data on the neurohormonal activation that I just mentioned. Now, it is worth noting that some studies suggest using aldosterone antagonists and or ARNIs. But I'll say that the strength of these recommendations in like sort of guidelines is tempered by the paucity of data. It's not like a class 1A recommendation in most cases.
So it sounds like neurohormonal activation does occur in HFpEF, though perhaps it's not as pronounced as in HFrEF with reduced ejection fraction, but it is there. And I guess I will say there can be a little bit of a spectrum here too, right?
Absolutely. Between,
yeah, these low normal EFs. Yeah.
There's moderate range EF, right? So which I'm not even going to touch that.
Right, exactly. Have these sort of, yes, exactly. Have these sort of low normal. And so, but I think for the purposes of these studies, they have to sort of characterize in this way. But, you know, going back to the central question, if neurohormonal activation does occur to some extent in HFpEF, but we can't really pin it on decreased cardiac output because that's not the problem in HFpEF, what can we attribute it to?
So for some patients, clearly not all, but for some patients, an explanation might be obesity. So I think the first thing to remember is that obesity is a common comorbidity in patients with HFpEF. Again, not seen in every patient, but it's more common in HFpEF than in HFrEF. And amazingly, something that totally shocked me when I first read it is that adipocytes have been shown to produce and secrete aldosterone all their own. This is like totally independent of the adrenal glands.
Why? Why is that?
Yeah, like why would they do that? Yeah, that's obviously the question that I had. And this is what gets me, like I see the results of these papers and so I immediately am like, okay, I got to find what they say in the background or the discussion that explains this. And there are multiple potential reasons. One is that adipocyte-derived aldosterone might enhance adipogenesis and adipocyte hypertrophy in kind of an autocrine fashion. And the aldosterone might also have vascular effects at the level of the adipocyte, which are beneficial to that cell or to that subset of cells, even if it leads to sort of detrimental overall effects to the body. But you know, this seems intentional. And I think the reason I say that is it's not just the adipocyte that's secreting aldosterone itself, but there are actually other mechanisms by which they increase aldosterone. And one involves a hormone that I think many of us have heard about but haven't necessarily thought of in the context of HFpEF, and that's leptin.
So that's the hormone. Leptin's the hormone that blocks hunger, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, it was discovered in 1994, and it's kind of gone from being the satiety hormone to having dozens and dozens of effects. And one of these, again, totally news to me, was that it, through various mechanisms, can also increase aldosterone levels. Not something I would have predicted. And so I think if you take some of these studies together of patients who have obesity and elevated aldosterone levels, it kind of supports this idea that in obesity-associated HFpEF, the aldosterone isn't simply a result of cardiac dysfunction, but is actually a product of the adipose tissue itself. Now, this, I'll be totally honest, doesn't explain the elevated renin and norepinephrine levels we saw in some of these studies. But it kind of makes the point that there are mechanisms other than reduced cardiac output that are almost certainly at play here. And I got to be honest, I'm kind of excited to see how this mechanism of sodium retention may play out in the sort of years ahead.
Can we also just give a shout out to adipocytes for being like endocrine glands, essentially, secreting all these hormones? Like, that's incredible.
And to the listeners, I don't know if it's adipocyte or adipocyte. I'm going with adipocyte, but the adipocyte proponents just recognize that I know you're out there.
I still wonder how this plays in with like leptin and cardiac cachexia, which is this sort of like paradoxical weight loss that we see with decompensation, though I don't know that that's sort of been studied yet.
And I'll say there's also this interplay with neprilysin and leptin and aldosterone. And, you know, Milton Packer, who was the sort of the first person to coin the term, you know, neurohormonal hypothesis back 20 some odd years ago, he's kind of been on the forefront as well of a lot of this obesity-mediated aldosterone and sort of leptin-neprilysin-mediated hyperaldosteronism. So it's kind of cool that he's shepherded two different sort of main mechanisms.
Amazing. Okay, so let's assume that, you know, because we know that the neurohormonal activation with HEF-PEF is sort of a little bit more tepid and weaker than HEF-REF, so maybe it's not enough to cause sodium retention on its own. What alternate explanations have been offered?
Yeah, I got to say that this is really understudied, and I find that shocking given how common HEF-PEF is. One of the theories I came across has been proposed by James Fang and others. So Dr. Fang is a researcher and the chief of cardiovascular medicine at the University of Utah. And he has wondered if primary renal sodium retention plays a role in HEF-PEF. So the idea here is that the kidneys become sodium avid not in response to some external stimulus, like decreased effective circulating volume, but they are then instead themselves the instigator, kind of reclaiming the sodium independent of decreased cardiac output, decreased effective circulating volume. And this kind of idea that they're just sort of bad actors reclaiming sodium without an external signal, it's the kind of they're going rogue. This is something we talked about in episode 31 when we covered the mechanism of edema and nephrotic syndrome. Because remember there, it wasn't decreased effective circulating volume, the quote-unquote underfill hypothesis, but rather the overfill hypothesis that was the kind of the key thing that many nephrologists feel like is going on.
Yeah, I guess you could call it NEF-HEF when that happens.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, it makes sense. There's clearly a link between chronic kidney disease and HEF-PEF, although it's always hard to diagnose both simultaneously since they affect each other so much. But that seems to make a lot of sense.
This connection between CKD and HEF-PEF, I think that's right. And Dr. Fang has suggested that HEF-PEF might kind of sit at the renal end of the cardiorenal syndrome. And I got to say that the exact mechanism and interplay, it remains to be elucidated, and I got to hope there's people out there who are working on it. When you read the studies and the reviews, there's a lot of hand-waving about endothelial injury and inflammation, and I'll be honest, it's a little bit beyond my understanding how those would lead to primary sodium retention, but it's, I think, felt by many to play a role. But kind of remarkably, this is the best alternative to neurohormonal activation that I encountered in the kind of 4 years that I've been searching for an answer. And this, again, for like the third or fourth time, is kind of one of the main reasons why I'm interested to see what the audience has to say.
Amazing. All right. Well, I'm interested to see too. What do you have any final thoughts for them to set them on their journeys?
Yes, I definitely do. So I think the final thought is that I think this discussion highlights the heterogeneity of HEF-PEF. It's a clinical syndrome, and it's a clinical syndrome of heart failure with a preserved EF, but it results from a lot of different conditions, a lot of different sort of comorbid conditions. Like for some, the main driver might be CKD, and for others, it might be obesity, and for others still, it might be hypertension. And so we kind of shouldn't be surprised that the data on the pathophysiology, on the neurohormonal activation, all this is murky. And I think these different phenotypes often get lumped together, but I don't know, maybe they shouldn't be. But that's, I think, for the cardiologists of the world to figure out.
Thanks so much, Tony. I feel like this was sort of one of those unknown unknowns where I'm not necessarily thinking
totally
that, that it's like aldosterone coming from adipocytes that could be, part of the problem, or that the kidneys themselves are the main issue. So thank you so much for that. But do you have any take-home points for us?
Yeah, so I've got three take-home points. So number one, HEF-REF is associated with decreased cardiac output and neurohormonal activation, and this is probably the main way that these patients become sodium avid. HEF-PEF, alternatively, is associated with preserved cardiac output, at least at rest, and less neurohormonal activation. And so the sodium avidity in HEF-PEF, I would say, remains obscure. For some, it might be due to primary renal sodium retention. For others, it might be related to obesity-mediated increases in aldosterone. And for others, still, there's probably other mechanisms that we just haven't found. So I would say stay tuned. My hope is in the years to come, we're going to find out a lot more about this.
Awesome. All right. That wraps up another episode of The Curious Clinicians. Thank you, as always, for joining us. As a reminder, you can join our mailing list at CuriousClinicians.com to stay up to date on episode releases and have detailed notes delivered directly to your inbox. We are excited to partner with VCU Health to offer CME and MOC credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals just for listening to this episode. For more information, you can visit ce.vcuhealth.org/curiousclinicians. And as always, the information contained in this episode is for educational and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Until next time, we've been the Curious Clinicians.